From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Reporters for the Salt Lake Tribune have won a Pulitzer Prize for their investigation of the way sexual assault victims were being treated at Brigham Young University. Their series of reports actually came to include the handling of sexual assault cases on other campuses in the state, but the story really began at BYU and with the story of Maddie Barney, who was a sophomore when she was raped, and her file was passed along to the Honor Code office. Barney, who had been sexually assaulted, was now subject to an intrusive investigation into her moral conduct. Now, some things have changed in the years since the story broke. Schools are now reforming their systems, it seems. And so today in the program, we'll have some of the Tribune reporters with us to talk about the investigation. So we invite you to join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was a year ago today that the Salt Lake Tribune published the first in a series of stories exploring the treatment of sexual assault cases and sexual assault victims on college campuses in the state. And the first story in the investigation may have been the most outrageous. It was the story of Maddie Barney. She was a sophomore at Brigham Young University when she says she was raped. And she reported it to the Provo police, and along the way, a county sheriff's deputy passed her file along to BYU officials, and they passed that along to the Honor Code office. Now, it turns out during the course of the investigation, Tribune reporters found that a number of BYU students were being scrutinized by the school's Honor Code office after reporting sexual assaults. The Tribune's investigation moved on to other campuses, including the stories of four separate women who said they'd been assaulted by USU football player Torrey Green, even though no charges had been filed at the time. Eventually, the Tribune reporters looked at the way sexual assault cases were being handled at campuses throughout the state, including a federal investigation for possible mishandling of an assault report on the campus of the University of Utah. Now, all of this work has earned the Tribune the Pulitzer Prize. You've probably heard that by now. It was announced earlier this week. And all of that is just giving us a chance to talk about this story, how it played out, and what has happened since. Sheila McCann is joining us, the managing editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. And Sheila, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having us all.
Rachel Piper is the newspaper's digital editor. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Erin Alberti is with us. These days, she's the Tribune's outdoor columnist. Previously covered public safety. She's been covering this story right from the beginning. So welcome to you.
Thank you.
Jessica Miller is with us. Welcome.
Hi.
And Alex Stuckey, they're both reporters at the Tribune. Welcome to you.
Hi.
I should mention we have links to their coverage of all of this, and we'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A lot of that we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on how you're feeling about that, but how are you feeling in that few days after it? I know you were elated, I guess, at the beginning, but what are you thinking now?
You're looking at me when you say elated.
I am. What's wrong with you? You're sort of the boss.
This is Sheila. Yeah, the photographs, I do look pretty elated, but I can tell you when I look at them, my mind was just saying, wait, what? Wait, what?
I can that be right?
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it.
Really? You didn't have a sense that
I thought it was possible we had a shot at being one of the finalists.
Did you have the champagne purchased?
No.
No, okay. I wondered.
Yeah, our senior managing editor did. Even though he was worried about the jinx.
Yeah.
He worried about, okay, if I buy it, do I jinx? What if I buy it but I don't chill it, do I jinx?
Yeah.
Where's the line here?
Yeah.
I thought we perhaps had a shot at being a finalist. I did not think that we would win.
So
as we were listening to live stream, people were kind of at their own desks, quietly listening. Some maybe not letting on that they were listening.
Yeah.
I was trying to be very casual about this. When I understood that they were only announcing the winners, they weren't saying, and this runner-up, and this runner-up, I thought, well, I'll just have to wait. I'll have to wait till the end. They'll post a press release that will say who the finalists were. So I kind of quit listening.
Really?
Then I thought I heard, I was actually working on SPJ contest entries. And then I thought I heard him say something about sex abuse or sex assault. And in the moment I thought, wait, what did he say? I heard our photo director start screaming on the other side of the room.
Yeah. Erin, what did you think? Did you think you were...
No, I mean, I didn't watch the broadcast or anything. When I saw that people were watching it, I was kind of like, oh, like, why is everybody watching this? It's just going to end up making them all bummed about stories that I thought had accomplished quite a bit if we don't win something or when we don't. So I didn't even watch it. I was working on a hike of the week. So I was trying to map directions to the Warner Valley dinosaur tracks. So you can check that out in the Outdoors page this week. But yeah, so
Wait, explain that. So you're worried that if we don't win a Pulitzer, then all this work has been for nothing.
No, not that it's not going to be for nothing, just that it was going to be like a moment of needless disappointment about it. And so, I mean, I wasn't even listening. And so when I heard...
The screaming.
Yeah, well, I heard some yelping, and at first I thought maybe somebody had dropped something. And then Sean Means is, like, looking around, and he says, you want a Pulitzer? And I said, for what? I mean, like, I meant what category, but I just was in a fair bit of shock at that point. I saw people coming over to hug Sheila, and I just was very confused.
Sheila, you looked stricken, kind of in tears in the photos that I've seen.
I guess I was in tears. I truly was in shock, and it just felt like such an immense recognition. And I just was overcome with gratefulness to be recognized for the amount of work that so many people did. Look at all these women.
Yeah.
This is just the core. Our newsroom rallied behind this. So many people worked on these stories for months. And to have that recognized was just overwhelming.
I know we're all hoping that the financial fortunes at the Tribune are changing now. But it wasn't that long ago, of course, that the paper went through this incredibly difficult time. Some really gut-wrenching layoffs, of course. The staff had been pared down pretty significantly. How much of a challenge was that? You know what I mean? Like, I know that since Paul Huntsman has purchased the paper, things are changing in some ways, but it's still a smaller core. And I'm wondering how much of a challenge that has been.
I think of that in two different ways. One, when this work started, our future was so uncertain. We knew that we were being shopped around. Mm. There was litigation underway. Mm. Our future was very, very unclear. So the fact that we were able, as much as we did, to focus on this and just keep a sustained focus, keep learning, keep pursuing this, I think is incredible when you think of where we were. And then in the middle of it, we had a sale. We had a new owner. What was that going to mean? We didn't know. It didn't distract us from this work. And that's really impressive. But then the other part of it is we are smaller. Mm-hmm. When we went out on Monday night, we realized that that was a 3-year anniversary of a layoff.
Wow.
So the resources that we were able to pull and keep on this in a sustained way, it was harder than it would have been a few years ago. And it took a lot of letting things go, a lot of decision making we wouldn't have had to make even a couple of years ago. So I think that's something that may be inspiring for other outlets our size, that we were able to continue to draw, to trade horses at times when other things were happening, keep the focus and keep pursuing this the way we did.
Well, and so this is Jessica.
Yeah.
A lot of it, like for Aaron and I, we were on the justice desk and we still had to do like our regular jobs on top of this. Like we weren't given this role of investigative reporter and now you can go do your own thing. Like Aaron still had to work a Monday night shift most of the time. I still had to go to court and do these regular court stories. So we were kind of doing this juggling act of, you know, doing the daily newspaper thing, but we're also working on these other things also.
That's so interesting. So it was... It's not like it was a night job, but in some ways it kind of was. It was not exactly the gig you had. Yeah?
Yeah, it was kind of an all hours thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of late night editing and conversations with some of the people that we had to talk to, you know, were
college students hours are for interviews. I was interviewing some students at 2 a.m.
Wow.
Yeah.
At what point did you all, and we'll sort of talk about how this all begins here in a second, but at what point did you realize that there was something bigger here, that there was a theme or that there was a larger story than just this kind of outrageous story of Maddie Barney at BYU? I mean, when did you start to see something bigger?
Well, Maddie wasn't the first person I interviewed. And I started interviewing victims after...
This is Erin Alberti, by the way. I just need to...
Hi, sorry.
A lot of women's voices. I'm going to try to get them. Yes. So, ahead, I'm sorry.
So I was able to start identifying and interviewing students who had reported sexual assault after Maddie came forward in a campus forum on sexual assault for Sexual Assault Awareness Month just about a year ago.
Yeah.
I had been looking into this possibility for a little while before that, but I had only been able to find sources who were talking kind of speculatively, like it's possible that the honor code would deter crime reporting if people think that it's going to put them in the path of an honor code investigation. After I had heard about Maddie making a statement about this happening to her in a sort of public place on campus in a public situation, I started looking around social media very quickly for other people saying, this happened to me or this happened to my friend. Maddie had this conversation on a Thursday. Made this statement on a Thursday. I found out about it on a Friday. By the following Monday, I'd interviewed 12 students who said that they were raped while they were at BYU and their various accounts of what happened next. So it was pretty quick that I could see that there were a lot of people out there to talk to, and the the great willingness that they had to talk to me so immediately showed that there was some, I think there was a pent up story there, maybe something hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. You didn't know what it was necessarily at the time?
Well, after talking to that many people so quickly and...
started to become clear.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a lot more than just talking to the people. I mean, each of those interviews took, I want to say, at least an hour and a half or 2 hours. That's just for preliminary, what happened, you know, what are your recollections of this? Gathering documents and corroborating paperwork and details, background interviews... It took a couple of days after that for us to get our first story out. At that time, you know, I guess I hadn't really envisioned what was coming next. I mean, we had started making an outline of stories to address because I had found individual topics that were worth looking at in their own stories in the course of that early reporting. But one of the first things we did was put out a query online for readers to respond to. And that's when our source pool broadened quite a bit. I can let Rachel speak to that.
Yeah, we have a partnership with
American Public Media,
and it's the Utah Public Insight Network that allows people to share their stories with us. And so we put out a query saying, if you were assaulted while you were at BYU, tell us about it. And we, you know, we expected a handful of people would respond, but I think we got 70 or so really compelling stories.
Wow.
Yeah. And some of them didn't want to be interviewed. Many of them were willing to have phone calls with reporters. And that was just seeing all those responses pour in was really powerful.
How did you handle there's always that question of confidentiality and transparency. And it seems like it happened to you in a number of different ways. I know when you were trying to get the names from the Utah records for the number of people who had perpetrated sexual violence and you were turned down. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think, are you talking about, I think Annie Knox is...
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had made a records request details in cases that the Title IX offices at the public universities had taken. Now, that would exclude BYU. And I don't want to speak for this. I'm only speaking about this because I actually covered the records hearing. I wasn't involved in the records request.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that...
And we did... get those records. We didn't get quite the details that we wanted. Under a federal law known as FERPA, colleges are allowed to release the names of students who have been found responsible for committing a sexual assault on campus. but it says that they may release that information. It doesn't say they must. And so we received basically the number of students who had been disciplined for sexual assault, the nature of the school rule that they broke, and the punishment that they received, whether that was, you know, writing a paper or being expelled from school. So we did eventually get that limited information.
Wait, some people who had been accused of some form of sexual assault were told to write a paper?
Yes. I mean, that's in the minority, I would say, but – and it's hard to say, you know, what – there's no details in those reports, so it's, you know, they broke the school's sexual misconduct policy. Yeah. We don't know if that means that they are accused of assaulting someone or accused of stalking or, but the, you know, paper classes is a common form of sort of mediation.
I mean, we'll come back in more detail to what is happening and what's not happening on college campuses, but I think the reason I wanted to mention this particular point was one of the things the Records Committee said when they, I guess, initially said no to your request is that it would, here's the quote, deter victims from reporting misconduct and possibly create a risk of retaliation. Mm-hmm. And what did you think about that?
Well, the Tribune's policy, as I think you'll see stated in pretty much every story we wrote about this, is not to name people who report sex crimes unless they are okay with being identified. So it was, I mean, it was kind of up to the sources for that piece of it. I talked to a number, I mean, I can't even count how many interviews I had with students. I want to say, I know that altogether we heard from something like 50 or 60 students, but I think I interviewed something like 35 maybe, and there was a huge range in what people were willing to go forward with. I had a number of people call saying they just wanted to talk to me to say that they wanted to make sure that I knew that there was another person in the mix, even though they didn't want to be in the paper in any way. There were some people that were willing to go by first name only. There were some people, one woman asked for a pseudonym. She'd actually been attacked by the defendant in the rape case she was involved in, and there were charges filed. When she was at her campus job, the guy, according to the criminal complaint, came back and attacked her while she was working on campus. So there were people who had, you know, some concerns about retaliation. And then other people were willing to have their first and last name, photo, everything go out there. So, there were some students, I mean, I want to say the students, I think the only story that I wrote that didn't have at least one person with both their names was the story that I wrote about LGBT students that had reported being raped. And there was an extra sensitivity there, I could see.
I want to hear you. How much do you think, I think of the series as being really broad. I mean, eventually it's an investigation of what's going on campuses. But how much of... It seems to me that a lot of the attention for a lot of us, and it seems in some way by the Pulitzer judges, was just the BYU part of it. And what did you think about that? I mean, the series obviously is more broad than that, but clearly a lot of people were interested in the way BYU treated sexual assault victims. The whole honor code thing, it's really strange and unique, and I wonder... I mean, that. Do you see that as being, I guess, the core of the series? And what do you make of the fact when people just talk about that part of it? Because there's more to it, obviously.
This is Sheila. In some ways, don't see it as the core of this series. Mm-hmm. Rachel was talking this morning about reading all of the submitted stories at once. There are such broader themes. I think that catches people's attention.
Yeah.
The idea that you would ask someone who's been assaulted, who has reported being assaulted, what were you wearing? What were you doing? Putting the focus on the victim's decisions rather than the alleged perpetrator's decisions. I think that strikes people in a way that makes that draw the most attention. But we saw such big themes. We saw themes of schools just not having the right approach to this, not having victims at the focus of what their policies are. A sense that you would be glad that you had zero Clery reports, that you had zero people coming into your Title IX office. That just shows the focus is not on what are my students experiencing, what services do my students need. That is a big theme. A huge theme is not understanding consent. A story that Rachel did describing a Title IX employee going to a coach and saying, hey, there's a report, here's the deal, here's the details, to the extent that the local police said, that put people in danger to be doing that.
Yeah.
Clearly, even Title IX people were not understanding Title IX. The very first night, the very first story, one reason we were down there so late is we were arguing about Title IX, about BYU's policies. It was our beginning. It's not clear. It's not easy to understand. So getting clarity about what Title IX offers, the protections that it has, those to me are some of the big themes over all of these stories. And I'd like people to recognize those, as well as some of the things that really caught their attention about BYU.
Yeah. Wait, what was the argument about?
As I remember, it was kind of a sort of legalistic, just were we using the right language to describe the mechanisms of these policies?
Yeah. Well, and how cases got to the Honor Code office.
Right.
How did
they
go from a report to the Honor Code office? How did that happen?
And I guess it wasn't really an argument. You know, no one went home angry.
No. Yeah, no, it was like, but yeah. I think just kind of trying to bring in every, like, okay, but this happened in this case, that happened in that. So what is the policy? I mean, like, how do we crystallize this in a sentence?
Well, at the time, BYU was giving very limited statements, and their statement sort of was, we never refer a victim of sexual assault to the Honor Code office for being a victim of sexual assault. In their policy, though, it says basically the department responsible for handling student-on-student reports of sexual violence is the Honor Code investigator. But it's written in such a way that's, you know, really deep Title IX policy. And at the time, we weren't as familiar with that as we are now, where we could probably, like, you know, recite chapters of Title IX. And so I felt at the time, I feel like we could say that at some point the victim's case does go before the Honor Code office. We just didn't have that. We didn't have that knowledge, and BYU's statement sort of made it hard for us to feel confident about that. So we parsed it in different ways. And later it was sort of, you know, as we learned more, and BYU actually said, yes, sometimes victims' cases do go to the Honor Code. That was in their policy, but just the semantics at the time were so dicey that we couldn't go there.
I guess we should mention there's a woman named Sarah Westerberg who was the head of the Title IX office at Brigham Young University at the time. And she, if I understand this right, she confronted Maddie Barney at this gathering, and I'm not sure if she confronted her, but she was clear that the Title IX office would not apologize for sending some of this information to the reporting some of this information to the Honor Code office.
Well, and for the chilling effect, I mean, we talked to a lot of people who were at that forum. And in fact, Maddie Barney, as I was told by many people, confronted Sarah. But the thing about we don't apologize, apparently Sarah had actually acknowledged that we are aware that this has a chilling effect on sexual assault reports. So, I mean, chilling effect was her word.
Yeah,
so.
But why wouldn't she apologize then?
Because BYU has an honor code is the explanation that I heard from these students.
Now, she's no longer head of the Title IX office.
No.
Is that why?
Well, this change was made...
not so long ago, was it?
October, I think, is when.
Yeah, it was in October.
I can let Jessica speak more to that. She is, I think, most familiar with the changes.
We'll talk about some of the broader changes, too, but you want to mention
I think, if I remember right, she's still a dean. I can't remember exactly over what. So it's not like she's left the university or anything like that. They just kind of took her out of the dual role of being a dean and also the Title IX coordinator, and then they hired someone new for that position and kind of worked a little more to separate the Title IX office from the Honor Code office.
We have with us Sheila McCann, managing editor for the Salt Lake Tribune. Rachel Piper is the newspaper's digital editor. Erin Alberti is the Tribune's outdoor columnist. She has a really cool piece about hiking where this week?
Your hike of the week. Warner Valley Dinosaur Tracks.
Aaron's with us. So is Jessica Miller and Alex Stuckey. We haven't heard from Alex yet. Alex, we want to hear from you when we get back from a break. They all made major contributions, of course, to the Tribune's Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of sexual assault on Utah's college campuses. There's a link to their coverage, and there's a lot of it, on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. This is KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've gathered some of the reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune to talk about their remarkable reporting on sexual assault in campuses at the college campuses here in Utah. And by now, you've, of course, heard they won a Pulitzer for this coverage, and we wanted to bring them here to congratulate them, but also talk about how the story began and how it evolved. We have with us Sheila McCann, the managing editor of the Tribune. Rachel Piper is with us, Erin Alberti, Jessica Miller, and Alex Stuckey. Alex, I want to ask you, what did you learn along the way about what is reported, what isn't reported? I mean, you wrote that in 2015, for example, fewer than 60 sexual assaults were reported. But how much does that reflect reality?
Not very much at all. you know, those are the Cleary reports that we were talking about earlier. And the boundaries of what they have to report to the federal government are very tight, I guess is the right word. You basically have to be on campus, essentially. And that's particularly problematic in Utah because not a lot of colleges have on-campus housing. And if they do, it's very limited. So, you know, some of these schools have reported zero, which is, you know, not accurate at all in terms of how many of their students are actually being assaulted.
And Sheila, didn't you say they were proud of that fact that they had none of the, that? Like, yeah, this is amazing. There's no sexual assault on our campus.
Not all of them, but I've had schools say to me, you know, we know that's not all of the reports, but this is a safe place. And that's, you know, not fair to say. The University of Utah, for example, really, I don't know if you would say prides themselves on the growing number that are reported, but I think out of all of the colleges, they really are like, look, we have more people coming in and reporting these assaults. Like, this is a good thing. The fact that we have, I don't know, I think they had 30 or something this past year. That's a good thing. These students are coming forward and potentially getting the help that they need. So,
but do we have any indication how many sexual assaults are happening? Is that at all clear at this point?
I don't think so. And how many there, you can look at tons of studies that say how many people aren't reporting. You know, I would say between 80 and 90% do not, depending on the study that you look at. So it is very hard to gauge. Schools are now doing campus climate surveys where they'll ask, you know, have you been assaulted before you came here? Were you assaulted here? Did you know where to go when you were assaulted? That sort of thing. So I think that is sort of helping them get a better understanding of what the numbers might actually be. And those are pretty in line with, you know, national reports that say it's 1 in 5. Wow. Yeah.
Is Utah unique in any way from other campus environments or situations?
Oh, I mean, you know, the whole issue that we were talking about before, like people don't really understand what consent is because sex ed isn't really taught here. And so I think that, and Erin can probably speak to this too, a lot of people that I've talked to didn't understand what had happened to them. And, you know, they may have gotten there, but that meant they reported, you know, 6 months later or whatever. So I think in that way, it is maybe a little unique, although I haven't been reporting on other campuses across the country. But I think that there is that added element of, you know, what actually just happened to me.
You want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the course of my reporting, you know, I was a little surprised at the number of students that I spoke with who still kind of made reference to believing, even very recently, that, you know, that rape meant a stranger jumping from behind the bushes. I was surprised because I can remember, you know, even being in high school and sometimes feeling that all of the awareness education that was going on at that time, and this was 20 years ago, about date rape was kind of the catchphrase of the day, that I was like, okay, we get it. You can be raped by somebody that you know. I understand. I think everybody understands. But, I mean, that was my attitude at the time as like a 17, 18-year-old kid. But then 20 years later to see that idea still kind of being held to was surprising to me. And I like Alex, wondered if it was more of a local phenomenon, and especially since my focus was on these BYU students. But then the Brock Turner case blew up, mm-hmm. and I started seeing national reactions to that. And I saw, you know, comments and accounts of some statements made in relation to that case by college students that were also invoking the stranger in the bushes thing. And I thought, wow, this isn't just a Utah thing. I don't know if, like, nationwide we've regressed in education or what, but I was personally quite surprised to find out how pervasive this idea of stranger jumping out of the bushes and that's what rape is and it's not something else would be.
How much, we don't have to spend a whole lot of time with this, but one of the stories, Aaron, that you wrote with Peggy Fletcher Stack talked about the outdated LDS teachings that somehow contributed to this. Outdated ideas of, like, purity, Mormon concepts of, it's kind of the repentance process. Like, there's one story, for example, this woman named Catherine you talked to. She wouldn't let you use her last name. But in 2009, she was raped. And a friend, as you tell in the article, took her to the bishop of their student ward, and her bishop said, let's get you started on the repentance process. She had been raped.
Yeah, that was her account.
So I just wonder how much of this, what may make this unique might be the Mormon cultural part.
I mean, I think that there's certainly an element of that, and different students that I talked to had different expectations of, you know, what their own moral culpability was and what had happened. And I'm not like endorsing this idea that a victim has culpability. I'm just saying this is what the students told to me. For the LGBT students I talked to, it was pretty high, especially the male students who had been raped by other men. Those were pretty painful interviews.
There are bishops, though, that we were told about that made the people who came to them feel better about what happened, and actually were sometimes the first people to tell them, this is not your fault, you were assaulted. I talked to two women. That was their experience. They knew something awful had happened to them, but it wasn't until, you know, years later they confided to a bishop, and that bishop said, you don't have to feel bad about this. This was a crime. This happened to you. You don't have to repent. You're fine. And that's, you know, the interesting part of the Mormon religion is that it's a lay clergy. And so your experience is not going to be everyone else's experience. And the church itself is very clear. Sexual assault victims do not have any kind of fault for being sexually assaulted. But with a large membership and a lot of people in power, those messages sometimes don't get translated to the members themselves.
We should also point, I wanted to say, and we'll come back to this a bit, but BYU school officials have said they're going to follow these recommendations from this advisory council, which in your reporting you've called, you know, sweeping changes, really significant. But one of them doesn't seem to be training for bishops or other ecclesiastical leaders. That was one thing that may have been that troubled some. Will you say something about that?
There is a mention, I think, that the advisory council said, we will pass on that students have had varying experiences with bishops, with church leaders. But that is as far as they went.
Yeah. Anyone want to say anything more about that?
Well, and that was one of the things as we were talking with some of the people, you know, who Aaron initially talked to who had these experiences. That was one of kind of like the thing that they wish that would have happened, you know, that there would have been more training for, or they would have said something about the bishop's role and how they can be better, I guess, at doing those. Because like Rachel said, you know, it was such a varying experience depending on where you happen to be at, in what ward you happen to be in.
And I mean, I think it's important to point out that BYU doesn't like have any control over over bishops. I mean, there are student wards, and that's how the Mormon Church is organized. And there is a relationship because each student at BYU has to have an ecclesiastical endorsement, and if their bishop doesn't provide that, they can't attend anymore. But it's I'm not sure if that's the kind of thing that would appear on a list of priorities for BYU's action, just because they don't control the lay clergy.
I know, but the church owns them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's all of the church. Really, if the church wanted to, they could make that connection right away. No?
Right, but I mean, this report was prepared by a committee of BYU faculty, so and it was specifically about, you know, school policy. So I don't think that, you know, the people on that committee have any authority over church policy. So that's, I mean, I just sort of a structural
thing. But I guess the question is, does the church have to sign off on all of that stuff? Sheila, you're nodding your head over there. What do you think?
I would think so. Yeah. The church owns the university. And to your point, BYU deserves credit for listening. They say that they listen to more than 3,000 people giving them feedback. So I think there is power when they say, there's an issue here, we're passing along to you, church leadership, that people are having varying experiences. I understand why some people wish that would have gone farther, because they did have some authority to be describing that with a number of students and alumni and stakeholders that they spoke with.
Maybe say something more about some of the changes that they did recommend. And you all seem to see these as really positive. Sexual assault is no longer going to be shared with the Honor Code office. That was one of the things they all agreed to. What were some of the other things that you thought were significant? There were 23 different recommendations. Are they meaningful?
Well, I think that one of the big ones was that these victims would get amnesty from Honor Code violations.
The thing that Maddie Barney
was. Yeah, that was huge. That was the big thing. Though technically they haven't officially adopted it yet. I think I talked with BYU like just last week, and they said that they're operating under those guidelines, but the final language is still going through all the different committees or whatever it has to happen with the university. So they haven't finalized that language yet, but that's what they've said so far, is that they've been operating as if they had this amnesty policy, though it's not approved yet. But I think that was like the big thing for a lot of people, was the amnesty. If I go in and say I was raped, I'm not gonna get in trouble for being out past curfew.
Yeah. What about other reforms on other college campuses? What else are you seeing that has come from your reporting that where people are rethinking the way sexual assault victims are being treated? Alex?
This is Alex. Well, I think, you know, after our Tory Greene story, Utah State, I would say they're doing a lot. You know, they're trying to raise awareness for, you know, what consent is, so that students understand. And this sort of was in the works before my reporting, but they've got this new reporting system that would help them sort of track instances like the Tory Greene situation, and that, you know, even if someone was like, don't put my name anywhere, but this person did this to me, they'd put this in that system and they could go, okay, that's the third person. We need to have a conversation. You know, they also adopted an amnesty policy, right, like a month or so after that story. So, you know, they are doing things. They've got these task forces that are doing, you know, trying to figure out how best to help victims on campus that come forward.
It seems like another big part of the reporting was you unveiled kind of these flaws in the system that were surprising to some of us. Information sharing. Alex, you reported this. Schools weren't sharing information. So you could have a student who had, you know, problems with, you know, accused of certain sexual infractions on one campus, you know, they would transfer to go to, and it, mm-hmm. that information wouldn't go with them. Mm-hmm. Is that still the case?
Well, it's hard to say without having specific cases. Yeah. That was another thing that Utah State adopted after our stories, that, you know, they would put that on someone's transcript, even if they had transferred while sort of like a hearing or whatever was being conducted into this allegation on their campus. So they would sort of update the school. But I think, you know, that's a problem across the country, that they don't have to share that. So oftentimes they don't.
A survey conducted last fall by the University of Utah, and I think universities are doing this throughout the state, these surveys. And one of the findings from the University of Utah was that more than half of students didn't know where to report sexual assault. More than half, they didn't know where to get support or help. That seems crazy.
Well, in doing all this reporting, it's really not talking to all of these victims. But yeah, that's a problem. I mean, that was a problem at Utah State. Like, no one really knew where to go. I don't think schools really advertised what Title IX is very well. I think, you know, really before I started doing this reporting, I was like, it's sports. Title IX is sports. You know, yeah. I think that that's what a lot of people think. Yeah. And they don't realize that, like, they can go there and say, I really need to get this test pushed back because I can't do it right now. Or please direct me to counseling, you know. So I think that that's sort of a theme that I've seen across campuses, that students just don't really know that they can go there. Or they don't want to because they don't want to, like, accept help for it, you know. They want to be able to sort of push through it themselves. I think it's, you know, it's not just the University of Utah that's like that.
Yeah. It's Alex Stuckey. Jessica Miller and Aaron Alberty and Rachel Piper and Sheila McCann are with us. You can find links to all of their coverage of sexual assault on Utah's college campuses. By the way, it won them a Pulitzer Prize. RadioWest.org, you can find the links, or just go to the Salt Lake Tribune's website. We have a link to that on ours. Again, we'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have gathered some of the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune to talk about their coverage on sexual assaults on Utah college campuses. Sheila McCann, Rachel Piper, Aaron Alberty, Jessica Miller, and Alex Stuckey are some of the core reporters in the series. We have links to all of this, by the way, on our website, so you could go in and look. There's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Which is great. State reforms. I wonder what effect you're seeing. Laws were passed this session protecting the confidentiality of victims, requiring the testing of rape kits. How much of that do you think may have been impacted by the fact that you started raising these questions?
Oh, I don't know.
Really? I mean, I think some. I think, you know, maybe not the rape kits, because that's been a big issue.
They've
been talking about
years.
That. But the confidentiality thing, I think that became a really big issue, and still is, with the Tory Greene stuff. You know, just the schools not wanting to share anything with us because of confidentiality concerns, even though all of these women have talked to me. You know, that was also an issue because a lot of these women went to one of the counselors, I guess you would call her, and that information doesn't appear to have been shared through the proper channels. So, you know, this confidentiality issue was really something that came up, particularly in my reporting, I think. So,
I think it's hard for reporters to admit that their coverage is causing some change. But let's be honest. I mean, you've raised these really important questions. And it's amazing, actually, if you think about the – it's only been a year since you started reporting on it. Certainly, you must agree you've started to change the conversation. Yeah, you know, they're all shrugging.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, you don't want to talk about that. Let me ask you about the law enforcement part of this. This is something that you've been writing about. What did you discover about law enforcement and the way they treat these stories?
Well, one interesting thing that we found as we were kind of like digging through Maddie's case in particular, it became apparent to us that BYU police had been asked by the Honor Code to look into this countywide police law enforcement database. It's called Spillman. So to go into the Spillman logs and see and look at Provo police reports about what Maddie reported. And we have these records that show that a lieutenant at BYU police did that, went into those records and then relayed a lot of intimate information from that file back to the Honor Code office. And
that's outrageous. Yeah. I'll say it.
Okay.
I think you can objectively say that's outrageous, but anyway, keep going.
Yeah. And so once we saw that, we're like, well, how often is this happening? Is this a common thing that BYU police is accessing other police agencies' records? And so I filed a public records request, trying to see, you know, how often that happens. And then shortly after I filed that request, the Department of Public Safety opened an investigation looking into that exact thing. And that was last May. So they've been investigating this for almost a year now. And we haven't really seen anything about it. We don't really know much about what they've been looking at. We did get like a little bit of records that show that in like a 18-month period, BYU police looked at nearly 10,000 records from other agencies, which seems like a lot.
It does seem like a lot.
And looking at, you know, say nearby Utah Valley University, and you look at the same year time period, they're doing nearly half the amount of viewing that BYU did. So what that exactly means, we don't know yet, because it's a very, you know, it was what we could get records with it being an open investigation. We're only looking at like one little piece of the puzzle at this point, but that's something we're still kind of looking into and waiting to see what DPS finds out when they're what they release when the investigation's done.
What's next? What are the other elements of the story that you really, Sheila, what are you thinking about that you want them to dig into now?
Well, related to that, one of the lawsuits, we have three lawsuits that are still pending.
Yeah.
One of them is BYU at the beginning of our reporting process was responding to records requests. But when we got close to this topic, the topic of information being shared between police and the Honor Code office, they stopped and said, we're a private agency. We're not a public police agency. And there's been debate about that at campuses across the country. And we filed a lawsuit challenging that interpretation. That interpretation was reached by the State Records Committee. So we have received an initial ruling from a judge who refused to dismiss our case, saying it looks to her like there's a question here.
Mm-hmm. And the question is, even though they're private, are they actually private? Is that what you
mean? If they have all the powers of every other state police agency, all the powers, and obviously there's a lot of issues in this country right now about police power and transparency with police power. If they have all those, can they then say they're not a public agency and not open to any scrutiny? If one of these BYU victims wanted to see how police handled her case, could she be confident she was getting all that information if they're not subject to open records laws? The judge just seemed to be pointing out that didn't make a lot of sense to her. She had concerns about that. So she did refuse to dismiss the case, is letting it proceed. So that's something that we're still pursuing. There's still a lawsuit with Utah County, and there's still with USU, too.
Yeah, one of the other lawsuits, actually Utah County were the respondent in that. One of our reporters, Nate Carlisle, had asked for an internal investigation report for the deputy that gave the Maddie's case file to the Honor Code office. And we got some information, but there's just like pages and pages of blacked out information. And so the records committee granted Nate's request, but now Utah County filed a lawsuit basically challenging that, saying that these are private records because, you know, police officers should have that privacy, I guess. So that's still outstanding. And then I think Alex has a pending record lawsuit as well.
Everyone's got a lawsuit.
Yeah, so we've been trying to, right after the Tory Green story ran, the Utah State said, you know, we're going to look at what happened here. And through other records requests, you know, they admitted that they fell short in handling these. Three of those original four women were students, and they all told someone at the school who should have told a Title IX person, basically. So they came out with these, you know, recommendations based on that inquiry, and they're refusing to give us the inquiry. The State Records Committee went through, I mean, it's like hundreds of pages. And the State Records Committee a couple months ago went through and, you know, Alex gets this and page 1 through 50 here and, you know, and Utah State is saying no. So that is pending right now.
See, more work.
Yes.
We're essentially out of time, but just say something finally about Maddie's case. What's happening with that?
So Maddie's case right now, the defendant is scheduled to go to trial at the end of next month. So it's an 8-day trial. So that's coming up.
Well, congratulations one more time. Hope you feel proud and exhausted after all the celebrating. Sheila McCann, managing editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Sheila, thank you.
Thank you.
For coming in. Rachel Piper, the newspaper's digital editor, thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron Alberty, the Tribune's outdoor columnist, covered public safety before. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jessica Miller, thank you.
Thanks.
And Alex Stuckey, thank you very
Thanks.
Much. Again, they all made major contributions to their Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage, and you can find links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.